I think the discussion of the morning is appropriate to this season of the year. For while it is not essentially a devotional talk, it, I think, gives us some new dimensions and new recognitions of values in the descent of the Christian tradition. And in order to summarize the situation, we'll make an outline of the problems involved, but it is impossible in the time available to study the matter in depth. All we can do is mention a few of the outstanding circumstances. Up to the beginning of the 4th century, the Christian faith was very largely distributed in rural districts, in desert regions, and the churches and communions were isolated from each other. Most of the members of these groups were illiterate, and there was no actual organization or integration of what might be termed the basic doctrine. As 300 years nearly had passed, the isolated regions had developed not only their own peculiar viewpoints, but had already passed through several generations of conformity. The opinions of certain leading minds in these areas became orthodox and were perpetuated generation after generation. But in the different areas, these doctrines were not identical, and in many cases, not even similar. Each had its own interpretations, each had a combination of tradition and, we might say, romanticism. And the situation drifted along like this until an important occurrence took place, which was to change the whole shape of Christendom. In Alexandria in Egypt, which incidentally was the seat of the first seminary for the instruction of Christian priests, in Alexandria there was a very pious man by the name of Arius. This man differed from the prevailing doctrine of the Alexandrian synods. He decided that he could not conform with the teachings of the presiding bishop of Alexandria, whose name, incidentally, was Alexander. The bishop and Arius got into very serious conflict, and time went on, and there was considerable partisanism. Some of the bishops agreed with Arius, and this caused further consternation and discomfort to the presiding patriarch bishop. So, finally, he called a synod in Alexandria, in which about 100 bishops and other leaders of the communities gathered and officially excommunicated Arius. The debate was largely concerning the essential nature of Christ. The problem was that Arius believed that Christ was a spirit that overshadowed and entered into the life of body of Jesus at the baptism. Alexander took an entirely different point of view and declared that in Jesus Christ, God himself as a person, personally incarnated. Well, it was an abstract problem and was one of many that have arisen in the descent of the faith. But in any event, Arius was excommunicated, anathematized, declared to be a heretic and a traitor, and an incarnation of the Antichrist. This might have been all right, in a sense, as far as Alexander was concerned, but he had made one serious mistake. He had brought a very major controversy into public consideration. The story went all through the various Christian communities and seems to have inspired a series of other schismatic groups rising up with their own interpretations of these difficult subjects. Gradually, the Roman Empire became involved in a major dispute which threatened to break out into physical violence. In 313 AD, the Roman Emperor, Constantine the Great, had issued an edict to protect the Christians. There was to be freedom of belief within his domains. This was all right until this particular problem arose. And it looked as though the Christian community was going to be involved in a civil war, persecution, and other difficulties. Constantine, therefore, sent messages to both Arius and Alexander, asking them to reconcile their differences. They refused. He tried in every way possible to use his royal authority, but this was totally rejected. So after due consideration, possibly with the assistance of his secretary, a Christian convert of Eusebius by name, he hit upon a plan. He was going to call the entire Christian world together in one great council to declare and decide upon what they all could agree upon. The result was the convening in 325 A.D. of the Great Council of Nicaea. This council, which met in what is now a Turkish town, brought together about 600 bishops, presbyters, and their attendants and associates. Constantine entertained them all at his own expense, gave them living quarters and everything necessary, and appointed Eusebius as the secretary of the council. This seemingly was met with a certain amount of obedience, though not with too much enthusiasm, by most of the representatives of the various churches. Here we had these people, many of whom disagreed with each other, and before really they had settled down to consider anything, most of them had written private letters to the emperor accusing one of the others of something. This was a little difficult, but the emperor was rather able to handle the situation with imperial dignity. He burned all the letters. Having disposed of this situation, he convened the council and addressed it in person. Now, it is probable that while most of those present had no interest in the emperor whatever, and did not care what he thought, there was one situation they couldn't entirely neglect. He had the power to be very difficult if they insisted on irritating him. So, finally, the council settled down. The principal recorder of the council was Eusebius, and, unfortunately, he had very little to say. Not very much is known as to the actual workings of this council. Many historians have been up against it, and Eusebius' principal work, The Ecclesiastical History, gives no clear indication of what was accomplished. It is known, however, that the Congress met, that there were many debates and discussions, and some way, somehow, the problem of unifying the doctrines came into focus. Now we have to go back a little bit to another part of the situation. These old bishops and others who came to the council, some, by the way, passed on en route and never got there. They were the oldest people in their communities and the most venerated. And in most cases, each one had a doctrine very largely his own. There was no New Testament at that time. But each of the little churches had some kind of a relic which they regarded as very sacred. In most instances, this relic was a book, or a part of one, or a few pages of one, or a few lines of one. It was never read. It was wrapped in cloth or silk or some precious substance, placed in an ark, and concealed in an opening in the altar. There it remained, generation after generation, worshipped but not read. Against this situation, there were a number of traveling priests and bishops who wandered up and down the countryside, visiting these small churches. These visitors brought with them the news of the great Christian community. They told about world affairs, they told about the various conditions of the churches, and they also recited some parts of Scripture, or some legend, or some story they had heard relating to the life of Christ and his apostles. In this same book of Eusebius, by the way, there are a number of appendices by other early Christian scholars, and one of them is quite interesting. It is a list of the 12 apostles and the 70 disciples of Jesus Christ. The list is all named, numbered, and where they came from. And we know that the 70 has always been very important. But it is not noticed, at first at least, that it occurs in the numbering of the apostles and disciples. In any event now, these various prelates in their little local communities brought with them, at the imperial request, these fragments of sacred writings which had belonged to them, or transcripts thereof. In some cases, it is believed that the message was brought orally by the representative, who may not have been able to make a transcript. But in any event, all of these ideas were put together. And then all of the various records, everything that was brought to Nicaea, relating to Gospels and to sacred writings, were put together to be considered for the compiling of a Bible. Now, this again is not clear in Eusebius. No one knows how this selection was made. But it was a rather arbitrary one. And certain works were included and certain works were excluded by apparently a system of voting. In any event, at the end of it, these sacred writings were divided into two stacks. Those that were most generally accepted and voted as affirmatively divinely inspired. Those of doubtful origin or rejected works, which were put to the other side. After the decisions had been made, and what we know now as the New Testament had been decided upon, the question is, what happened to the other books? This is a very moot question. Some feel that in all probability they were destroyed. Eusebius, however, does not say they were destroyed. It is quite possible that a number of the delegates went back to their own communities and continued to follow their earlier personal conclusions and convictions, and that the actual decision of the Nicene Council was not followed completely. Out of the Nicene Council, however, there came the first manuscript forms of the Bible. Probably the most famous of these is the Sinaiticus, which was found in the monastery on Mount Sinai. It was for some time the possession of the Russian government and was later purchased by the British Museum. This is not a complete version. Parts are missing because the monks had already begun to throw away the old vellum as waste paper. But most of it was saved. And it is probably one of the most valuable manuscripts in the world. In this, we have the gradually integrating outline of the present form of the New Testament. It was in Greek, and the chances seem to be very good that the writing was actually done in Alexandria. Alexandria was the seat of the first, second, and third important leader of the Christian community, and also an area of scholarship where scribes and translators could be found to do the most difficult works with considerable skill. And now the question arises, what happened to the books that were not accepted? Were they rejected because, truly and obviously, they were not inspired? Were they rejected by uncertain votes? There is a report that some were partly accepted and partly rejected, and that in some instances those accepted only got in by one vote. But the fact remains, what happened to the ones that didn't get in at all? It has been believed that these have to be classified under two general headings. The first is the heading in which surviving works are known. About 30 of the Christian apocryphal and apocalyptical writings are extant. There are a number of fragments also that have been recently discovered. Add to these, perhaps the most important of all sources are the ones referred to by the early fathers prior to the Nicene Council, but never found. They are a number of quotations attributed to Christ and his apostles from Gospels that have never been rediscovered. It is not likely that the early church fathers fabricated these lines or these sections or these statements, But whatever happened, perhaps their sources were destroyed after the Council of Nicaea. In any event, there is probably a considerable group of sacred Christian writings that exist only as names and short quotations in the writings of other church fathers. Some were particularly well informed in this particular area and quoted many writers whom we do not know today. The next problem would be to try to determine the fate of those which did survive in some way. And here we have what we call the Christian Apocrypha. At the present time, approximately 30 books are known, in addition to the more complete scriptures, which in the early printed editions did include some of the books now regarded as dubious. There is also an Old Testament Apocrypha, which we won't be able to touch on today, but part of it, especially the book of Maccabees, was continued in the Old Testament beyond the time of the King James Version. Luther rejected the Apocalypse of John completely, and there's been controversy over many of these books. Actually, in addition to the Apocrypha as we know, there are a number of volumes, and some of the early fathers included among the Christian documents the writings of Valentinus and Basilides, the Gnostics of Alexandria. They were quite justified in doing so, and the recent discovery of the Gnostic library proves that as early as the 4th century, which is the time under consideration, these Gnostic books had many references to the life of Christ, to the ministry, and in the case of the Pista Sophia, which is certainly of the 3rd to 4th century, there is a detailed section devoted to the instruction given by Jesus to Mary of Magdala. Therefore, many of the Gnostic writings, both the Christian Gnosis and the Jewish Gnosis, do overlap and do definitely have references to the life of Jesus and his teachings. Those that have survived to us under more or less special headings, for the most part, have been decided to be of an optimistic nature by church historians in general. Most of the apocryphal lives of Jesus gave strong emphasis to his childhood, which is comparatively weak in the gospel versions. They also indicate that as a small child he performed numerous miracles, of which one, of course, was the creation of clay pigeons which came to life and flew, and several other similar episodes. Also, it is apparent from these early writings that there is no overshadowing of tragedy in most of them. They do not go into the tragedies of the effort to disseminate them, the ministry. Among the most interesting probabilities in connection with the apocryphal writing is to consider whether they formed a tone or an underlying quality which the Orthodox theologians were afraid of. And this is perhaps best noted in the Gospel of Nicodemus, which is very interesting and does include the death of Jesus and the descent into the underworld and the harrowing of hell in which he went down, and the discussions between the evil spirits of hell and the Messiah are very curious. But one of the most interesting is that the spirits of evil, speaking of sinners in their domains after death, said that they would be punished until it was time for them to be reborn again into the material world. This probably cost Nicodemus inclusion in the scriptures, because the Orthodox community was too severe on these particular points. There are many other similar interesting episodes and some very controversial ones. One of the most interesting and stimulating groups consists of the letters of Paul and to Paul in relation to Seneca. According to one of the apocryphals, Seneca, a Roman philosopher of considerable esteem, wrote many letters to Paul, the apostle, and in turn he wrote to Seneca. The tone of the apocryphal book is to the effect that Seneca, if not a convert, was very sympathetic to the Christian cause. And there was considerable discussion of fine points of theology. But for the most part, the letters were of a kind of general, kindly, and constructive attitude throughout the story. Another interesting group of material deals with the life of Pilate after the crucifixion of Christ. According to this particular little apocryphal section, he was returned to Rome, where he was made accountable to the emperor for his conduct. He took with him the seamless coat of Jesus, and whenever he was called into the presence of the emperor, he wore this coat. And while he wore this coat, the emperor could not convict him. So the emperor made arrangements for the coat to be taken away at a certain time. Then Pilate was convicted and executed for his bad judgment in connection with the death of Jesus. This becomes the basis of quite an elaborate structure in one of the apocryphal sections. We also have, of course, a number of the apocryphal books traced directly to the other disciples beside the evangelists. In other words, that St. Andrew contributed. Barnabas, who was with Paul for a long time, did the book that by his name among the Apocrypha. And the books of Hermas are very interesting and important. The Pro-Evangelium of the Pseudo-Matthew. Many of these works are probably worthy of inclusion in the present scriptural collection. However, if we study them very carefully, we are forced to admit that they do not add a great deal of specialized information. There is a legendary quality about many of them. They, however, nearly always are in conformity with the four Gospels and the Pauline epistles. They represent various extensions or amplifications of some of the ideas in the accepted canon. So we don't find anything that is going to finally solve any major controversy concerning the life of Christ. But we do find abundant evidence to support the major historical events related in the Gospels. We also find that there seems to be an effort, or was an effort, to depreciate mysticism. And a major, at least oblique, attack on the Egyptian Neoplatonism. The philosophy side of the Christian doctrine, as it gradually developed through Aquinas and St. Augustine, does not have much bearing in the apocryphal works. They are purely devotional and would appear to be based upon each other into a large degree. They are, however, very interesting and quite important in their contributions to our general knowledge. I think one point that was made by Constantine, it should be of great interest today. Constantine was by no means an extraordinarily noble character. Constantine was probably interested in Christianity primarily as a means of supporting his control of the empire. He was not a particularly virtuous man. In fact, he was either convicted or accused of a great many rather despicable acts. He was not able to be initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries in his own country because of his bad reputation. But Constantine did have one very interesting remark to make. And it was in about 320 that he made it. And it was a remark that I think is of still a great importance. He said, "Why does this new religion place so much emphasis upon theology and breaks itself into splinters due to its theological differences when it was evidently intended by the founder, as found in the four Gospels, to improve the moral life of man, to increase his spiritual insight, and to advance the cause of universal brotherhood without consideration for various sectarian differences?" Now, coming from a man who was not baptized practically until his deathbed, this is a very interesting thought. And it seems as though we can take that thought and precipitate it into the history of the Western religions and find how many times antagonism, suffering, have been caused by theological differences. Differences which had little or nothing to do with the daily life of a good Christian. So in this time, perhaps, in these difficult days that we are in at the moment, it would be wise for us to recognize what Constantine saw and several other things that perhaps were shown to him clearly by Eusebius, who was, of course, also responsible for the Nicene Creed, creed of his own church, little church, which was finally imposed upon all of Christendom. According to Constantine, the unity of a religious group, the unity of religion within an empire or a country is essential. The presence of a religion in a country is absolutely necessary. Now, regardless of how we may view him, he was a practical man. He said, when religion is debased, the government of a nation becomes impossible. That as long as people are divided concerning their belief in God, they are also going to be divided in everything else. Now, these thoughts probably come essentially from Eusebius, who was the mouth for Constantine on his religious matters. But Constantine agreed with them, justified them, and promulgated them, and insisted upon them. He could look back upon the Roman period in which Christians were thrown to the lions in the arena. He had already, long before this, declared religious tolerance throughout the empire. Now he saw that this religious tolerance was permitting individuals to variously distort religion to the advancement of their own conclusions. Constantine, not being a philosopher, not being essentially a mystic, probably had very little insight into the deeper and more subtle values of spiritual conviction. But he did see the effect of various religious mistakes upon the secular life of humanity. And those who came after him recognize his importance in the great council which he convened, but have paid very little attention to his thoughts about what religion was to be in the life of mankind. It's all summed up in his one major overthought, that he needed Christianity in the Roman Empire to hold it together. And all the rest was an expansion of this concept. Now, it is also true that there had already been a considerable amount of conflict, misery, and suffering caused by religious differences within the boundaries of the empire. So what Constantine was anxious to have accomplished was that there be a uniformity of belief, that the Christians were to get together and decide what they believed for once and for all. And having decided it, lived it. This was the important consideration. So the Nicene Council had its part to play. But at the best as we know it, from the records of this, which is, I say, very meager, there is very little indication that the various delegates went back and fulfilled the expectations or hopes of Constantine. They went back to nurse their wounds and bruises, and had a position very similar to that of a politician today who finds that his constituency no longer agrees with him. They were in this kind of a situation. For 250 years, some of these little churches had followed their own beliefs. Four or five generations of leaders had believed those very same things. The present incumbent believed these very things, but he was supposed to go back to his congregation and say he was wrong. Well, this is hard to do. Politically, it's almost impossible. If you have made a mistake, you defend it at all costs in order to save your own reputation. And this happened in a good many cases. But all in all, there was an improvement. There was a general recognition of the four Gospels, and although by the end of the 4th century AD there probably were not a dozen copies of them in existence, the influence and implications of them through the more advanced clergy was being felt completely throughout the empire. It was a time in which what we know as the beginnings of formal Christianity, and we then move from the anti-Nicene period to the post-Nicene fathers, who began to expand. The anti-Nicene, those before the Council of Nicaea, were, might we say, apologists. They were trying to get along with a non-Christian environment. They were therefore, as in the case of Clement of Alexandria and Origen, forced to make certain compromises. They couldn't really come out and call everybody else wrong. So they were careful to try not to offend everybody. But after the Nicene Council, the apologists faded away and the propagandists moved in with everything they had and insisted upon this uniformity and conformity of belief. Now, if it is true, as which it looks as though it was, that from the very beginning there was also a stream of mysticism, which perhaps, if we can hazard the thought, was carried along largely by the so-called rejected books. With most of the books no longer in existence, we do not know the full details, but the limited quotations, the small fragments that have come down to us in the writings of the church fathers, who were able probably to trace the originals, would indicate that there was a definite mystical content coming into the Christian faith at a comparatively early date. The apocryphal books, particularly those dealing with the life of Christ, also indicate a greater use of miracles, many wonderful happenings that have never gotten into the Orthodox Gospels, strange circumstances, natural phenomena, and all kinds of mysterious, mystical, almost magical elements. And it is probably because of these inclusions that many of the books were rejected for nonconformity. But even though this conformity was not acceptable, there is no doubt in the world that by the 4th century, Christian mysticism was reasonably firmly established. It was based upon one essential point, namely the possibility of interpreting various statements of the scriptures in a metaphysical manner. That while all things had their literal forms, it was quite possible that these literalisms were symbolical of something else. That everything was not to be taken literally. So most of the early fathers expected everyone to take these ideas literally. But as time went on, even before Nicaea, there is a strong evidence that in Egypt and in Athens, there was a metaphysical element coming in. And this metaphysical element was probably preserved in the Gospels most completely in the letters of Paul to the Corinthians. Here we have a considerable statement of a mysticism which also occurs in other of the Pauline writings which are now regarded as apocryphal. So we have the rise of a Christian mysticism. We also find that gradually the church accepted this. It accepted the possibility of a mystical experience in itself. And gradually the canonization of prominent church fathers depended on one of two factors, either martyrdom, which was the larger one, or a mysterious mystical experience of communion with deity. These two were the basic elements which contributed to canonization. Now, Christian mysticism has come down to us today. It has come down to us within the Catholic Church and also within the Protestant churches. In both of these communions, the mysticism has been largely censored by the doctrines of the sectarian itself. But in spite of this, a constantly increasing mysticism is evident. Now, one of the reasons why mysticism comes in is because with the passing of time and the changes of history, literalism loses dignity. Today, things that were accepted without question 100, 200 years ago are simply no longer tolerated. Interpretations that are completely literal have run against scientific, philosophical, and theological objections. So we have a tendency which began at the very early time to interpret all of the essential principles of religion in a mystical manner. This is also justified by the actual words of Christ himself. For he tells on one occasion that if they destroy the temple, he will rebuild it in 3 days. And someone said he means the temple of his own body. And this is an example of the departure from a literalism to an idealism that was compatible with the gradual advancement and unfoldment of human understanding. We also find that throughout the apocryphal books, there are to be found a number of apocalyptical experiences of beings lifted up into communion with deity. The only one of these books that survived in the Holy Scriptures, the apocalypse attributed to John. But there was one by Peter, there was one by Paul, there were several others by other disciples, and some by early church fathers. These experiences seem to be an effort to recognize the spirituality of the universe. In the days of the Egyptians and the Greeks, the idea of a physical universe with nothing but a physical foundation was unthinkable. And even the fathers of astronomy, Ptolemy of Alexandria, for example, recognized the idea that the physical universe was the shadow of a spiritual world. It was something cast upon the face of nature, which had its origin in a divine purpose or a divine plan. So the most of the apocalyptical visions found in the apostles and in the commentaries and the apocryphal works were based upon a system or concept of astronomy which had developed in Greece and Egypt and in Chaldea. We also realize that the apocalypse is very similar in its structure to the Muslim vision of the ascent of Muhammad into heaven. The idea is found also in the Kabbalah and in the early mysticism of the Jewish Kabbalists. In any event, the whole concept was, in all of these works, that the universe was a spiritual reality. That the physical forms that it existed were symbols, evidences of something greater than themselves. The point of view that the universe was created out of nothing was held for a time by the early church, but gradually relaxed away, because it was simply not possible to assume that something comes from nothing. But in any event, the main theme of the situation was represented by John in the Apocalypse, is that life is a spiritual mystery. That religion is the recognition of the reality of things unseen. That man himself is a spiritual factor moving through a spiritual world. But this truth is obscured by the restrictions of his own sensory perceptions. Therefore, the early communion had to believe and affirm, as is represented on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome, that the divine power of fashioning things, creating things, was in truth a deity, not merely a law, not merely a mechanics going on forever through time and space. That there was a divine mind and a divine consciousness and a divine soul behind the mystery of existence. And that the manifestation of this divinity was particularly summarized in the ministry of Jesus Christ. So that the apocalyptical books all have this flavor, but do not fully mature it. One of the reasons why they did not mature it was because to do so, they would have been required to accept certain non-Christian principles, already well known and in circulation in the areas. So it was best not to go into detail on this, but to maintain the simple fact, undeniable and irrefutable, that this universe is essentially a spiritual reality. Most of the apocalyptical writings assume this, the Apocrypha intimate it. And they also intimate in various ways the importance of the individual's acceptances of certain truths. I think we may also say that the apocryphal books contain a number of allegories like the accepted volumes, which require interpretation to even make reasonable sense. They are parables, they are symbols, they are myths, legends, all of which, however, are founded in the spiritual fact of man's existence in a divine plan. Now today, there's another kind of controversy that has arisen, which is no longer relating either to the accepted gospels or the possibility of enlargement through apocryphal means. The head-on collision today is between what we might term materialism and idealism. The non-believers of antiquity were regarded as heretics. The non-believers of today pride themselves that they are scientific intellectualists. They believe what they believe, just as all these little priests and bishops back in the 3rd century and 4th century believed what they believed.